Wherever you are. Well, brethren, what do you think about when you think of the name Jesus Christ? What word comes to mind? What word or words would you use to describe him? And why that word? Here's a few options for you to consider. There's many words you could use to describe the word. Which did you choose? Any of these? Now I'm going to change the question here a little bit. Which descriptor can we truly emulate now in this life? Which one of those can we truly emulate in this life right now? Well, this afternoon, I would like to focus on Jesus the teacher, the greatest teacher of all times. As ambassadors for Jesus Christ, it's his teacher qualities that we can exhibit each and every day as we go out these doors today. So let's go through and see what we can learn and how we can better emulate him as a teacher. Jesus obviously was the greatest teacher there ever was. But what does it mean when he doesn't answer the questions? When questions are asked, but no concrete answers are given, shouldn't a teacher have all the answers? Today we'll look at the many questions that Jesus asked and the questions that he asked and how very few times he gave a very concrete black and white answer to the question that he was asked. Jesus himself asked many questions but provided very few answers. So what does that mean? What does it tell us about him as a teacher? And what can we learn from this type of teaching? As parents or as ambassadors for him, what can we learn from that? In fact, Jesus Christ asked 40 times more questions than he ever answered directly. 40 times more. Why is that? Maybe instead of providing answers, he's inviting us to meditate on the questions themselves. He's inviting us to meditate, to cultivate the wisdom we need to navigate through this life, to be sent out among the nations, to be taught, to be teachers out in the world, to emulate him as his representatives. So I've titled this message, Wisdom Gained Through Questions, the Greatest Teacher of All Times. So it appears Jesus asked 40 times more questions than any direct answers he ever gave. And this sermon was inspired by is a book I read, and the book is called Jesus is the Question, the 307 Questions Jesus Asked and the Three He Answered, which is actually 100 times more, but I'll get to that a little bit later. You're welcome to borrow this book after Colette does. She said she gets the next reading of it. It's an excellent book if you want to dive into this subject more. So the questions of Jesus. Can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to the span of your life? Who do you say I am? Do you know what I've done for you? Jesus asked all these questions and many, many, many more that we'll see. And his followers asked a lot of questions of him. Some seemed simple enough, and the answers of some just seemed absolutely obvious. Through his questions, though, Jesus called his listeners to reflect more deeply on his message. At times, his questions even challenged them to go beyond their preconceived notions of what it meant to be his followers. Did Jesus have to ask questions? Did he know all the answers? Well, yes, of course he did. Jesus had all the answers to all the questions that could have ever been asked. But that wasn't his mission. He came to bring an understanding, not just an answer. From a teaching perspective, to have an understanding is so much more different than having the answer. And that's what Christ focused on, was providing an understanding. I mean, you can go to Google right now, and you can Google any question you want, and you'll get an answer. But Google's not going to give you an understanding. One of the most powerful ways to use questions is in the scope of education, or even more specifically, in the scope of parenting with our children, teaching and learning and mentoring. And as I said, from a teaching perspective, having the answer is very different than having an understanding of the answer. Once a person understands the answer, they can navigate other questions and other problems from that understanding that they've gained. So why is the sky blue? Is it because the oceans are blue, they cover the majority of the earth, and the sun reflects off the oceans and makes a blue hint into the sky, turns it blue? Or is it because the wavelengths of the sun? Or is it because aliens came at one time and painted it blue? What will the answer be? As a teacher or a parent, when you ask a question like this, you would unlock something. If you're humbly asking a question and not trying to reinforce an answer that you want to hear, but you're truly asking questions with students or with children, you unlock an imaginary world where all is possible, anything is possible by these questions they're trying to figure out, they're trying to understand. What could it be? What are the possibilities? Was it aliens? Is it a reflection? What could it be? It could be anything. It's a beautiful thing when children come and they ask you a question because the sky is a limit. Anything's possible, and they need to know. They want to learn to understand. As a teacher and a parent, you could simply respond directly. You could tell them the answer. That's easy. The atmosphere scatters certain frequencies of light, giving a blue contrast to the atmosphere. Done. There's the answer. What did they learn? That's middle school. I can tell everybody's forgotten middle school science class. That's middle school science class. That's what they taught us. But as a teacher or a parent, our job is not to give answers. As a parent, it's not to give the answers. You're trying to exercise the brains of our children, trying to get them to think so they become critical thinkers and they can evaluate things. You want them to be using their brains and not just trying to learn the answers to something. Not trying to make them into encyclopedias that just can regurgitate a certain thing, especially encyclopedias that are biased, because that's called indoctrination. It's not what you want to do. You know, here are the facts, and you shall never leave from that. No, that's not how you teach children. They need to have the understanding there. It needs to be an understanding. We should be very intentional in teaching our children to solve problems and to be critical thinkers. When it comes to everything, when it comes to how they spend their money, when it comes to responding to situations, interactions with other people, even their faith, we want them to ask questions. We want them to explore that. We want them to understand and to navigate that. They should feel comfortable navigating any and all information out there. And they should recognize what's propaganda so they can discard that from the equation. This is what critical thinkers will learn. And they should never be afraid to ask questions and always be suspicious if someone tells them not to. So if a child asks, why is the sky blue? You could tell them the answer, as I just regurgitated from middle school science class. Or you could jump on this bandwagon and teach them as Christ taught his disciples. And you do that by responding to their questions with questions. Okay, the sky is blue. What is the atmosphere? What's the sky made of? Well, air molecules. Remember that? Mostly nitrogen. There's some oxygen. There's a few trace elements that people think are destroying the ozone layer. There's things like that, carbon dioxide and other stuff. But there's basically nitrogen and oxygen are the air molecules in the atmosphere. How can we see the sun? Well, the sun gives off light. Does light travel in different wavelengths? Yes. Yeah, it does. Invisible light, like blue and violet, have the shortest wavelengths of the spectrum. That's how we see colors. So when white light comes from the sun, it contains all the wavelengths. It contains all the colors from the sun. When it hits something, the wavelengths are absorbed, and some wavelengths are scattered. Something that is truly black absorbs all of the light from the sun, and none of the wavelengths are scattered. Something that is blue, or something, is absorbing most of the wavelengths except the shortest ones, the blue and the violet, and those are reflected off, and that's why you see blue and violet. That's how you see that. What would happen if the density of the air molecules in the sky allowed most wavelengths of light through but scattered some of the shortest wavelengths, like blue? Well, then the sky would appear with a shade of blue, sky blue. When the sun sets or rises, light is traveling from the sun, but now it's going through more of the air molecules, more of the atmosphere to reach you. So does the sky get lighter colored or darker colored? Well, it gets darker colored. It gets more intense blue at that time. More is being absorbed as it's going through the atmosphere. You've seen those beautiful sunsets and those more intense blues. As I said, more blue is getting scattered before it reaches your pupils. So what color does the sun look like when it's setting or rising? More blue is coming out. Therefore, it turns the sun more of an orange-red color. That's why, as it's going down on the horizon. Isn't God's creation absolutely amazing when you sit there and just go piece by piece by piece of everything that God created? So now if you're talking to your child and the child is asked that question, they have a better understanding of why the sky is blue. A whole new world of possibilities now has opened up to that child. Things they can navigate, other answers they can come up with based on their understanding. I have a quote here from Albert Einstein, and it's actually in this book. And it was from a different context, but I think the quote still applies to what we're going to talk about here this afternoon. Albert Einstein said, "If I had an hour to solve a problem and my life depended on the solution, I would spend the first 55 minutes determining the proper question to ask. For once I know the proper question, I could solve the problem in less than 5 minutes." It's gaining an understanding from the question. Now, there are many different types of questions we can ask. There's those closed questions, yes or no, black or white. You know, did you pray this morning? That's a yes or a no. You either did or you didn't. There's open questions. You know, how are you feeling after your surgery? Feeling a little foggy, a little bit achy? How are you feeling? And there's some questions are used to influence people which really aren't meant to be answered. The rhetorical questions meant for like rhetoric. You know, who's going to pay for this if the government takes this over? It's not meant to be answered. We all know that. It's just meant to people to think about, to bring a response. It's meant to be pondered on. So there's many different types of questions, but questions are meant to get you to think in specific ways, especially the types of questions that Jesus Christ asked. Questions are powerful. So how many questions were asked concerning the sky, the blue sky inquiry? Why is the sky blue? How many questions is that? One question. And how many questions in response to give an understanding and not just an answer? Was it 6, 7, 8 questions were asked back to give an understanding of that initial question? So in the gospel accounts, Jesus is asked 183 questions from his followers, from spectators, from the Romans, from the religious leaders. Out of the 183 questions, he only answers about 8. Some argue as little as 3. In the book, they say 3. Other people say there's 8. 3 to 8 doesn't really matter. It's pretty small that he actually answered directly. Jesus, however, chose to ask 307 questions. And he answered anywhere between 3 and 8 directly. Jesus taught not as a guy to provide all the answers. He was not the first century Google. He's the guy that asked the questions to provide an understanding and not just the answers. Jesus Christ wanted his disciples then and now to outgrow the status of a student. You're always going to be the status of a student if you just know the answers. He wanted them to outgrow the status of the students. He wanted them and us to have an understanding so that we could become teachers, so we could take that knowledge and we could shed it to others. We could go out the door, as you know, we talked about in the sermonette. What are we going to do when we go out that door? What are we going to take with us? To emulate him as a teacher. But by asking questions, He wants us to gain an understanding. He wants us to learn and cultivate the wisdom that comes from meditating and struggling with those answers. Because if we enter a world with no understanding, right outside the door, if we leave with no understanding, just hard answers, we're going to appear to the world nothing less than fundamentalists, have radical ideas, just wanting to indoctrinate everybody. If we can't provide an understanding, specifically in the realm of relationships. Because it's easier to strip someone of humanity in the name of right answers than it is to engage with them, another person, and trying to understand and have an understanding. In the Gospel of Luke is the first time we see Jesus recorded as engaging or speaking with anyone. This is in Luke chapter 2. And it's when Joseph and Mary go to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover in the days of unleavened bread. And they brought 12-year-old Jesus with them to the festival. And like good parents, they lost him. Now, most parents have experienced this, right? Who's lost their children? Okay, most people have lost their children at one point or another, whether it was at Walmart, whether it was at the airport, you know, whether the grocery store, you're looking around, the kid is no longer there. They're just gone. They're just gone. But here's the good news. At least you didn't lose Jesus. The King of the world. The angel came and announced him as a virgin birth. The Messiah, the divine by divine decree. He's the climactic of the divinic lineage and kingdom. He's the long-awaited king. His domain will last forever and ever. He's important. Lost him. They didn't just lose him at Walmart. And back in the day, you would just go up to the front and play the shame game, and they'd announce you, and either your parents or you'd come up to the front desk, and that didn't happen. No, they left Denver's Walmart, and they drove all the way to Kansas City before they realized they lost him. And then they started searching for him. And this is what happened here, Luke 2, verse 46. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. 3 days for you parents. 3 days. They went back to Walmart. They did not find him for 3 days. Did they sleep? What was going through their minds? Were they stressed? What were they thinking for 3 days? If your kid ran off and it took you 3 days to find him, how would you feel? Probably have mixed emotions when you find him. Maybe want to hug him. Maybe want to something else. What do you want to do after 3 days? In this account, this is the first time that Jesus is recorded as speaking. And what is he doing? He's asking them questions. And it says the teachers of the temple were amazed at his understanding. When I used to read this verse, I used to always think that Christ was asking questions for understanding. And I now view this as he was actually teaching at the age of 12, providing the understanding, because they were amazed at his understanding. I've looked at it a completely different way now after putting this message together. And hopefully you'll see that as we go through this. But a real life question here for the parents, for those of you who have lost your children. If you or your spouse lose your child and they ran off, when you find the child, which spouse is going to take the lead on being vocal? Is it going to be the wife? Let's see here. Mary rolls up in verse 48. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son," I know there's no tone in here, but I'm sure there was a tone at the time. "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." "Why were you searching for me?" 12-year-old Jesus asked him. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Would you? Look what Jesus does here. Mary asks him a question, and he responds to his mother's question with two questions. It's starting. He's already becoming the greatest teacher ever known. And this is the first time Jesus recorded his speaking. And he's asking two questions for one question. Now, I don't know what happened at that moment. I don't know what took place between Mary and Jesus. It's not recorded for us. However, I don't believe for a moment that Mary was amused at the events that just happened. Case in point, let's look at verse 51. Something happened between then and this moment here. Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart, and Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. He begins by asking questions. And the last words on the cross was a question. Why have you forsaken me? Also a question. What are you looking for? What are you looking for? It's the first thing Jesus says in the Gospel of John. What are you looking for? John looks up, sees Jesus walking, says, "Behold, the Lamb of God." Two men, these disciples, began to follow him. So he turns to them as they're following him, and he says, "What are you looking for?" When the soldiers came to arrest Jesus in the Gospel of John, they arrive, and Jesus asks them the exact same question. What are you looking for? What's interesting, Jesus asked the very same question again, this time after his resurrection, when Mary's at the tomb and she's crying, and he comes up and he asks her, he says, "Who are you looking for here at this empty tomb? What are you looking for, and who are you looking for?" If Jesus asked these questions right now, what would your answer be? You're following him. What are you looking for here? What are you chasing? It may not even be him. Or it may be something you want through him, or under the pretense of following him. Many of us are looking for peace, if we get down to it. We're all looking to be loved. Everyone wants to be loved. Ultimately, I think we're all chasing a sense of rest. Rest that can only be found through Jesus Christ. So what are you looking for, was the question he asked. And who are you looking for? When we stand with weapons in hand, ready to fight, ready to arrest someone, he asks, "Who are you looking for?" Jesus is probably asking the same question every time we armor up for conflict, every time we get in an argument with someone, we want to give it our way. He's probably asking that same thing. Who are you looking for at this moment? Jesus' questions sometimes has us examine what we are truly longing for. And when we realize that, things start to make sense in our lives. Because the things we long for are the things that we're going to chase. Jesus' questions calls us to reflect, as in Luke chapter 7. In Luke chapter 7, Jesus is having a dinner meeting with a Pharisee named Simon. He gets invited to this dinner with this Pharisee, and this Pharisee is a teacher of the law. You know, this Pharisee understands the importance of the law. He understands the importance of the commandments. He's an expert, and I use that in quotes, in keeping the commandment and the law. He kept all of them. This is the Pharisee. And he saw Jesus in some regard to invite him to dinner. And a woman busts in. And she falls and she weeps. And she washes Jesus' feet with her tears and her hair. And she pulls out oil and anoints them with oil. The Pharisee, the religious, righteous one, the one who made the law his all identity, that he was known for keeping all of the laws and the commandments, he thought to himself, if Jesus only knew this woman, what kind of sinner lifestyle she's been living, if he only knew, if he was really a prophet, he would know he would never let this woman be touching his feet. He would never let her touch anywhere with her hands. And Jesus knows what's in his heart, and he calls him out on it. He says, hey, got a question, talking to the Pharisee. He says, two people have a debt to the patron. The one owes him 500 denarii, the other owes him 50 denarii. Neither can pay back the debt to the patron, so the patron forgives both. Which one loves the patron more? Well, this is one of the obvious answers. Well, the one who owed 500 denarii, of course. And then Jesus looked at the Pharisee and asked a surprising question. Do you see this woman? That's the question. Do you see this woman? Luke is very intentional in including this question. It's irrelevant to the story. Everyone saw the woman. She's kind of making a big scene here. She's busted in. Of course the Pharisee saw the woman. That's not what he's asking. He said, do you see this woman? He says, I came in and you gave me no water for my feet, but she washes them with her tears. You didn't give me a kiss at all. She can't stop kissing my feet. You didn't give me oil for my head. Yes, she pours out oil on my feet. Her sins are forgiven, so she pours out her love. And then he says this to the Pharisee, those who are forgiven little, love little. Do you see this woman? The Pharisee, he didn't see a woman. The Pharisee didn't even see a human being. What he saw was a stereotype. One of those people, that's one of those that's a sinful one, lives a sinful lifestyle. It's one of those people that just came in here. He did not see a woman. All he saw was how much better he was than that sinful one that just came in. So let me ask a question, brethren. Why did you come here today? Why did you come here today? There's typically two types of Christians, and this is a very generality. And I'm talking about for all churches, not talking specifically in this congregation, but in all churches. There's typically two types of people that go to church. There's those that go to validate their identity as righteous so they can save themselves. Or they can go to heaven, they can save themselves. It's all about saving themselves. And there's those that go to worship the one who has forgiven a debt so insurmountable, all they can do is humbly bow their heads and ask for forgiveness. Both types of Christians worship together, side by side, in the same room. Yet one spends a time looking at Christ, the other spends their time looking down at the other. Jesus had a parable about that. Do you see this woman? Do you see the human being behind the stereotype? Jesus' questions also show us respect, as in Mark chapter 10. Here in Mark chapter 10, Jesus is traveling through Jericho, and they're struggling through a massive crowd as they're working their way through the city, in which there was a blind man. And the blind man begins to scream out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. He's loud, he's annoying, he's obnoxious. People are telling him to shut up, be quiet, shut up. He's like, okay, you tell me to shut up, I'm going to yell louder. Son of David, have mercy on me. You don't want me to yell for Jesus? I'm going to yell louder. Jesus hears him and says, bring him to me. So the same people that told him to shut up said, okay, great, now he's heard you. Probably the tone they used, let's go, you know, take him up to Jesus. And they brought this blind man to Jesus, and Jesus asked him a question. And this is a question that as disciples called to engage in a world around us, I think this can teach us a lot about love, mercy, and grace. So brings the blind man up to Jesus, and what does he ask him? What do you want me to do for you? What do you want me to do for you? Okay. Where's Captain Obvious? He's blind. What do you think he wants him to do for him? Jesus didn't presume. He knew what the guy needed. That's the kind of attitude that can lead to arrogance paid with righteousness. You know, look at this poor person. I know what they need, and I'm going to give it to them, and I'm going to fix it because I'm... No, that's not what he did. He didn't view this blind man as a stereotype, but rather as a human being. Jesus is teaching us how to show respect for fellow human beings, not for a blind man, but human, a fellow human being. This man is screaming out for something, and maybe it's something else than the obvious. Maybe it's because he has a sick child, like there's so many others that were in the scriptures that had sick children. Or maybe it's because his family is starving because of his condition. He can't work, and he needs some of that food that Christ could easily provide. Or maybe it's something else that he needs, and we'll never know until we ask. So by asking, Jesus is not presuming. He's asking and he's listening. He's not defining this man by what he sees and assumes. And we're supposed to be able to help others in a boundaryless scope. But all of that is worthless without respect and humility, which is what Christ is showing. So Jesus asks the man, and the man responds, "I want to see." Okay. Jesus heals him. And after that, the man starts following Christ. A relationship had been formed. Would that relationship have been formed if brought him up and Christ just healed him and that was it? Instead, Jesus approached the man with humility and respect. He approached the man like a servant. And he asked a servant's question, "What can I do for you? What can I do for you?" This is how he teaches us to respond to the world around us as a servant, never looking down, never labeling, other than a human being just like us. Jesus' questions test our potential of how far our love has to reach, as in Luke chapter 10. In this account, the man, he's a lawyer, he's an expert in the law, asked Jesus a question, and he said, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Does Christ give him a direct answer? Now, that's a rhetorical question. If you learned anything from this message, you probably know the answer to that. Did Christ give him a direct answer? Well, what do you think? No. Instead, he asks a bunch of other questions in response to this question. Christ says, "What is written in the law? How do you read the law?" And the man responded, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus says, "Great, you got it. Good job." But the man didn't accept this because he wanted to justify himself. He wanted to justify his love and how far it was going to reach. So the man asked another question. "And who is my neighbor?" He's asking Christ how far he's obligated to go. How far is he obligated to love? Is it just his family? Is it just those who read the Bible? Or is it just those who attend my own church? Where's the line? Where's the line, Christ? What's the line that my love has to reach? Well, what's our line, brethren? Do we have one? Do we have one now? So did Jesus answer this question directly? No, he doesn't. He tells a story in response. He tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. And we all know the parable about the Judean man that was beaten up, robbed, left for dead on the road, and all these religious leaders, all these people came by and went to the other side of the road and passed by, left him. And the Samaritan came and he helped the Judean man, healed his wound, took care of his wounds, took him to an inn, and paid for the cost for his recovery. The Samaritan helped the Judean man when all those religious leaders would not. And Jesus asks, who is the man's neighbor in this parable? The answer, of course, is the one who gave mercy. In the parable, the Samaritan is singled out not because he helped the man. It's because at that time in the entire world, he was the least likely person on the planet to help a Judean man, the Samaritan was. The Samaritans and the Jews were savage enemies at this time. They hated each other. All the news stations in Judea would write, nasty articles about the Samaritans. The Samaritans post insulting memes back. I mean, they really hated each other. They were savage enemies. And they continually were attacking each other. And they all did this in the name of God, because each of them viewed themselves as the one on God's side. But in this parable, Jesus flips it around, and the one who shows mercy was the neighbor. In other words, the stereotypes, the demographics, all flew right out the window concerning this question. Why? Because our love has the potential of reaching that far. And that was the point, and that's the scope of who the neighbor is. So who is the Samaritan in your life? Who's the Samaritan in my life? It's a question that doesn't always have a clear answer. But who's the Samaritan? I'm not talking about the good one that came and took care of you, but I'm talking about the people that we stereotype. We haven't actually talked to, though. Or the people that we stereotype and have never been generous to. Or the people that we stereotype and never give an ounce of grace to. It's a question worth reflecting on. Something I have to reflect on myself. Jesus' questions challenges our righteousness, as in Luke chapter 6. In Luke's gospel, Christ tells the Sermon on the Plain. You know, Matthew, it's a Sermon on the Mount. They say it's a Sermon on the Plain in Luke's gospel. But Jesus asks some rhetorical questions here. He says, if you love those who love you, what credit is to you? Even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who did good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners will do that. If you lend to those whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners, even the wicked, even the fill in the blank will do that. But love your enemies. Do good to them. And lend to them without expecting repayment in return. That's tough. That's tough, brethren. It's hard to do. But Christ says if we do that, your reward is going to be great. Why? Because that action is emulating the action of the greatest teacher ever known to mankind. You're emulating Jesus Christ by doing those actions. Mercy, humility, faith, forgiveness, love, all of these are actions that emulate Jesus Christ. Do you see this woman? What can I do for you? Someone's sinful lifestyle is not a good enough objection for us not to ask these types of questions if we truly want to emulate Jesus Christ. Someone's animosity towards us is not a good enough objection for us to ask these types of questions if we truly want to emulate Jesus Christ. Someone's opinions that we may strongly disagree with are not good enough objection for us to forfeit following Christ. So what's next? How do we apply all of this? Newsflash. With a dramatic pause. We're likely going to enter into another crazy time in this world very soon. And why do I say that? Very likely, as we all know, if you've had your head above the sand for a while, there's going to be another health crisis. There's going to be another financial crisis. There's going to be another food crisis. And if none of those at least come about, there's the 2024 presidential election. Buckle yourself in. I hope this message helps us in navigating this time that is coming upon us. Navigating it in a way that shows God's love, in a way that shows His mercy, in a way that is a true reflection of Him. Because Jesus says, the measure of judgment that you give is a measure of judgment you will receive. Do you see this woman? Do you see this teenager? Do you see this child? Do you see this fill in the blank? What can I do to help you? Brethren, we can have opinions. All of us have opinions. I've got a million opinions. None of them are right, but I get a million. All of us can have opinions. But humility must come first. Because if people don't see humility, opinions are never going to leave the echo chambers that they were voiced into. only our identity of being our self-identity, it won't, instead of having a reflection of Jesus Christ. So this upcoming time will potentially have the opportunity to reflect Jesus Christ. Do you see this Republican? Do you see this Libertarian? Do you see this Democrat? That human being, apart from the stereotype that we want to place on them. Do you see that liberal? That conservative? That progressive? Or that human being? Jesus calls us to embody the ethic of loving others as ourselves. And it's hard. It's hard when we have strong opinions and we know our opinion is right. It's very hard sometimes. When we see another person, remember this. Realize they breathe just like you and I. They have parents just like us. They may have kids. They get scared. They may have joy. They have stress. They have anxiety. But they long for rest, just like you and me. And they have an insurmountable value, just like us. The moment we take the status of another human being, take the insurmountable status out of the value of the eyes of God away from them, is the moment that we stop following Jesus Christ's example. I will say I need to do a better job in reflecting Jesus Christ in my life. And if I don't do it for myself, I need to do it for my kids and my grandkids. Because I'm the example of Jesus Christ that I serve and follow in their eyes. They watch me to see the teachings of Jesus. The next generation is watching all of us. Our acceptance to follow the teacher, to emulate him, is a huge responsibility in this life. I can only speak from my own experiences, and I'll ask you to speak for your experiences, for yourself. Well, Jesus asked a lot of questions, 307 questions to be specific in the Gospels, and only gave 8 direct answers. Because Jesus focused on teaching us how to solve problems, and how to develop wisdom, and how to respond to unique situations and circumstances and conflicts. Do we listen to Jesus when he asks questions for us? I hope this message is useful for all of us, because this world is truly on fire. There is an outright attack on our children right now in this world. I don't know how many of you have seen that movie, The Sounds of Freedom. It's already been pulled off out of the theaters because it brought too much to light. And it talked about the human trafficking, specifically around children, and the $150 billion a year industry that is, and how the U.S. is the largest consumer of that industry. If you haven't seen the movie, it's well worth watching if you can find it. But there's ways we can help, too, even locally, outside these doors. There's many organizations. I know Tim Tebow has an organization that works, I think, with foster kids and the sex trafficking kids. But there's even locally here, Help and Hope is one that serves locally in the community, just a local one that works there. There's also, we've already talked about the fundraiser today for the Alternatives Pregnancy Center. Do you know in Colorado last year there were 14,000 abortions? 14,000 just last year. I was looking, there's a brochure Clint and I were looking at this morning from Alternatives Pregnancy. And one of the things, I was just flipping through it this morning, one of the things that just jumped out at me that it hurt to read. But you know, there's an abortion pill that people can take. And the abortion pill is to kill the baby. And there is a abortion pill reversal, which is something else they can take within a certain amount of time that eliminates the chemicals to kill the baby, and they can keep the baby. And so in the brochure, that one of the services they used to provide was talking about that, and there's a stamp over top of this that says, effective April 14th, 2023, Senate Bill 23-190 was signed into law by Governor of Colorado. The law prohibits Alternatives from providing abortion pill reversal medical protocol. Therefore, this is no longer a service alternatives is allowed to provide. They're not even allowed to provide guidance on stopping an abortion. This world is on fire. Are we going to contribute to it, or are we going to be bold enough to run in it? Bold enough to follow Jesus Christ's example in the hardest situations that may be before us. So I'd like to conclude with a time of reflection. This will take about a minute. I'm not going to say anything. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to show some of the questions that Jesus asked. And I'll ask you, don't write these down. I've got a whole bunch of handouts. I got all the questions here. I'll leave them up here in the front if you want a list of them afterwards for these questions. And for those online, we can have you text Sam if you want to get email. I'll be email you the questions. But I'd ask you right now just to read these questions, and Elmer's going to read them to Vicky for me. And so I'd ask you now, reflect on these questions. These are questions that Jesus asked a variety of people in a variety of situations. But right now, he's asking you. Sometimes giving a direct answer doesn't achieve the goal. It's the questions that help with understanding. And that's why Jesus Christ is the greatest teacher of all times.